Steinberg said. In late August, on our last night in Cambridge, there was a final dinner in the Great Hall. The tables were set with more knives, forks, and goblets than I'd ever seen. The paintings on the wall seemed ghostly in the candlelight. I felt exposed by the elegance, and yet somehow made invisible by it. I stared at the other students as they passed, taking in every silk dress, every heavily lined eye. I obsessed over the beauty of them. At dinner, I listened to the cheerful chatter of my friends while longing for the isolation of my room. Professor Steinberg was seated at the high table. Each time I glanced at him, I felt that old instinct at work in me, tensing my muscles, preparing me to take flight. I left the hall the moment dessert was served. It was a relief to escape all that refinement and beauty, to be allowed to be unlovely and not a point of contrast. Dr. Carey saw me leave and followed. It was dark. The lawn was black, the sky blacker. Pillars of chalky light reached up from the ground and illuminated the chapel, which glowed, moon-like, against the night sky.
"You've made an impression on Professor Steinberg," Dr. Carey said, falling into step beside me. "I only hope he has made some impression on you."
I didn't understand.
"Come this way," he said, turning toward the chapel. "I have something to say to you."
I walked behind him, noticing the silence of my own footfalls, aware that my keds didn't click elegantly on stone the way the heels worn by other girls did. Dr. Carey said he'd been watching me.
"You act like someone who is impersonating someone else, and it's as if you think your life depends on it."
I didn't know what to say, so I said nothing.
"It has never occurred to you," he said, "that you might have as much right to be here as anyone."
He waited for an explanation. "I would enjoy serving the dinner," I said, "more than eating it." Dr. Carey smiled.
"You should trust Professor Steinberg. If he says you're a scholar, pure gold, I heard him say, then you are."
"This is a magical place," I said. "Everything shines here."
"You must stop yourself from thinking like that," Dr. Carey said, his voice raised. "You are not fool's gold, shining only under a particular light. Whomever you become, whatever you make yourself into, that is who you always were. It was always in you, not in Cambridge, in you. You are gold. And returning to BYU, or even to that mountain you came from, will not change who you are. It may change how others see you, it may even change how you see yourself. Even gold appears dull in some lighting, but that is the illusion, and it always was."
I wanted to believe him, to take his words and remake myself, but I'd never had that kind of faith. No matter how deeply I interred the memories, how tightly I shut my eyes against them, when I thought of myself, the images that came to mind were of that girl, in the bathroom, in the parking lot. I couldn't tell Dr. Carey about that girl. I couldn't tell him that the reason I couldn't return to Cambridge was that being here threw into great relief every violent and degrading moment of my life. At BYU, I could almost forget, allow what had been to blend into what was. But the contrast here was too great, the world before my eyes too fantastical. The memories were more real, more believable, than the stone spires. To myself, I pretended there were other reasons I couldn't belong at Cambridge, reasons having to do with class and status, that it was because I was poor, had grown up poor, because I could stand in the wind on the chapel roof and not tilt. That was the person who didn't belong in Cambridge, the roofer, not the whore. "I can go to school," I had written in my journal that very afternoon, "and I can buy new clothes, but I am still Tara Westover. I have done jobs no Cambridge student would do. Dress us any way you like, we are not the same." Clothes could not fix what was wrong with me. Something had rotted on the inside, and the stench was too powerful, the core too rancid to be covered up by mere dressings.
Whether Dr. Carey suspected any part of this, I'm not sure. But he understood that I had fixated on clothes as the symbol of why I didn't and couldn't belong. It was the last thing he said to me before he walked away, leaving me rooted, astonished, beside that grand chapel.
"The most powerful determinant of who you are is inside you," he said. "Professor Steinberg says this is Pygmalion. Think of the story, Terra."
He paused, his eyes fierce, his voice piercing.
"She was just a cockney in a nice dress. Until she believed in herself. Then it didn't matter what dress she wore."
Chapter 29. Graduation. The program ended, and I returned to BYU. Campus looked the way it always had, and it would have been easy to forget Cambridge and settle back into the life I'd had there. But Professor Steinberg was determined that I not forget. He sent me an application for something called the Gates Cambridge Scholarship, which, he explained, was a little like the Rhodes Scholarship, but for Cambridge instead of Oxford. It would provide full funding for me to study at Cambridge, including tuition, room, and board. As far as I was concerned, it was comically out of reach for someone like me, but he insisted that it was not. So I applied. Not long after, I noticed another difference, another small shift. I was spending an evening with my friend Mark, who studied ancient languages. Like me and almost everyone at BYU, Mark was Mormon.
"Do you think people should study church history?" he asked.
"I do," I said.
"What if it makes them unhappy?"
I thought I knew what he meant, but I waited for him to explain.
"Many women struggle with their faith after they learn about polygamy," he said. "My mother did. I don't think she's ever understood it."
"I've never understood it either," I said. There was a tense silence. He was waiting for me to say my line, that I was praying for faith, and I had prayed for it many, many times. Perhaps both of us were thinking of our history, or perhaps only I was. I thought of Joseph Smith, who'd had as many as 40 wives. Brigham Young had had 55 wives and 56 children. The church had ended the temporal practice of polygamy in 1890, but it had never recanted the doctrine. As a child, I'd been taught, by my father but also in Sunday school, that in the fullness of time, God would restore polygamy, and in the afterlife, I would be a plural wife. The number of my sister wives would depend on my husband's righteousness. The more nobly he lived, the more wives he would be given. I had never made my peace with it. As a girl, I had often imagined myself in heaven, dressed in a white gown, standing in a pearly mist across from my husband. But when the camera zoomed out, there were 10 women standing behind us, wearing the same white dress. In my fantasy, I was the first wife, but I knew there was no guarantee of that. I might be hidden anywhere in the long chain of wives. For as long as I could remember, this image had been at the core of my idea of paradise. My husband and his wives. There was a sting in this arithmetic, in knowing that in the divine calculus of heaven, one man could balance the equation for countless women. I remembered my great-great-grandmother. I had first heard her name when I was 12, which is the year that, in Mormonism, you cease to be a child and become a woman. 12 was the age when lessons in Sunday school began to include words like purity and chastity. It was also the age that I was asked, as part of a church assignment, to learn about one of my ancestors. I asked Mother which ancestor I should choose, and without thinking, she said, "Anna Mathea." I said the name aloud. It floated off my tongue like the beginning of a fairy tale. Mother said I should honor Anna Mathea because she had given me a gift, her voice.
"It was her voice that brought our family to the church," Mother said. "She heard Mormon missionaries preaching in the streets of Norway. She prayed, and God blessed her with faith, with the knowledge that Joseph Smith was his prophet. She told her father, but he'd heard stories about the Mormons and wouldn't allow her to be baptized. So she sang for him. She sang him a Mormon hymn called, Oh My Father. When she finished singing, her father had tears in his eyes. He said that any religion with music so beautiful must be the work of God. They were baptized together. After Anna Mathia converted her parents, the family felt called by God to come to America and meet the prophet Joseph. They saved for the journey, but after 2 years they could bring only half the family. Anna Mathia was left behind. The journey was long and harsh, and by the time they made it to Idaho, to a Mormon settlement called Worm Creek, Anna's mother was sick, dying. It was her last wish to see her daughter again, so her father wrote to Anna, begging her to take what money she had and come to America. Anna had fallen in love and was to be married, but she left her fiancé in Norway and crossed the ocean. Her mother died before she reached the American shore. The family was now destitute. There was no money to send Anna to her fiancé, to the marriage she had given up. Anna was a financial burden on her father, so a bishop persuaded her to marry a rich farmer as his second wife. His first wife was barren, and she flew into a jealous rage when Anna became pregnant. Anna worried the first wife might hurt her baby, so she returned to her father, where she gave birth to twins, though only one would survive the harsh winter on the frontier. Mark was still waiting. Then he gave up and mumbled the words I was supposed to say, that he didn't understand fully, but that he knew polygamy was a principle from God. I agreed. I said the words, then braced myself for a wave of humiliation, for that image to invade my thoughts, of me, one of many wives, standing behind a solitary, faceless man. But it didn't come. I searched my mind and discovered a new conviction there. I would never be a plural wife. A voice declared this with unyielding finality. The declaration made me tremble. What if God commanded it? I asked. You wouldn't do it, the voice answered. And I knew it was true. I thought again of Anna Mathia, wondering what kind of world it was in which she, following a prophet, could leave her lover, cross an ocean, enter a loveless marriage as a second mistress, then bury her first child, only to have her granddaughter, in 2 generations, cross the same ocean, an unbeliever. I was Anna Mathia's heir. She had given me her voice. Had she not given me her faith also? I was put on a short list for the Gates Scholarship. There would be an interview in February in Annapolis. I had no idea how to prepare. Robin drove me to Park City, where there was an Ann Taylor discount outlet, and helped me buy a navy pantsuit and matching loafers. I didn't own a handbag, so Robin lent me hers. 2 weeks before the interview, my parents came to BYU. They had never visited me before, but they were passing through on their way to Arizona and stopped for dinner. I took them to the Indian restaurant across the street from my apartment. The waitress stared a moment too long at my father's face, then her eyes bulged when they dropped to his hands. Dad ordered half the menu. I told him 3 mains would be enough, but he winked and said money was not a problem. It seemed the news of my father's miraculous healing was spreading, earning them more and more customers. Mother's products were being sold by nearly every midwife and natural healer in the Mountain West. We waited for the food, and Dad asked about my classes. I said I was studying French.
That's a socialist language, he said.
Then he lectured for 20 minutes on 20th century history. He said Jewish bankers in Europe had signed secret agreements to start World War II, and that they had colluded with Jews in America to pay for it. They had engineered the Holocaust, he said, because they would benefit financially from worldwide disorder. They had sent their own people to the gas chambers for money. These ideas were familiar to me, but it took me a moment to remember where I'd heard them. In a lecture Dr. Carey had given on The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The Protocols, published in 1903, purported to be a record of a secret meeting of powerful Jews planning world domination. The document was discredited as a fabrication, but still it spread, fueling anti-Semitism in the decades before World War II. Adolf Hitler had written about the protocols in Mein Kampf, claiming they were authentic, that they revealed the true nature of the Jewish people. Dad was talking loudly, at a volume that would have suited a mountainside, but was thunderous in the small restaurant. People at nearby tables had halted their own conversations and were sitting in silence, listening to ours. I regretted having chosen a restaurant so near my apartment. Dad moved on from World War II to the United Nations, the European Union, and the imminent destruction of the world. He spoke as if the three were synonyms. The curry arrived, and I focused my attention on it. Mother had grown tired of the lecture and asked Dad to talk about something else.
"But the world is about to end," he said.
He was shouting now.
"Of course it is," Mother said. "But let's not discuss it over dinner."
I put down my fork and stared at them. Of all the strange statements from the past half hour, for some reason, this was the one that shocked me. The mere fact of them had never shocked me before. Everything they did had always made sense to me, adhering to a logic I understood. Perhaps it was the backdrop. Buck's Peak was theirs, and it camouflaged them, so that when I saw them there, surrounded by the loud, sharp relics of my childhood, the setting seemed to absorb them. At least it absorbed the noise. But here, so near the university, they seemed so unreal as to be almost mythic. Dad looked at me, waiting for me to give an opinion, but I felt alienated from myself. I didn't know who to be. On the mountain, I slipped thoughtlessly into the voice of their daughter and acolyte. But here, I couldn't seem to find the voice that, in the shadow of Buck's Peak, came easily. We walked to my apartment, and I showed them my room. Mother shut the door, revealing a poster of Martin Luther King Jr. that I'd put up 4 years before when I'd learned of the civil rights movement.
"Is that Martin Luther King?"
Dad said.
"Don't you know he had ties to communism?"
He chewed the waxy tissue where his lips had been. They departed soon after to drive through the night. I watched them go, then took out my journal. It's astonishing that I used to believe all this without the slightest suspicion, I wrote. The whole world was wrong. Only Dad was right. I thought of something Tyler's wife, Stephanie, had told me over the phone a few days before. She said it had taken her years to convince Tyler to let her immunize their children because some part of him still believed vaccines are a conspiracy by the medical establishment. Remembering that now, with Dad's voice still ringing in my ears, I sneered at my brother. "He's a scientist," I wrote. "How can he not see beyond their paranoia?" I reread what I had written, and as I did so, my scorn gave way to a sense of irony. Then again, I wrote, perhaps I could mock Tyler with more credibility if I had not remembered, as I did just now, that to this day, I have never been immunized. My interview for the Gates Scholarship took place at St. John's College in Annapolis. The campus was intimidating, with its immaculate lawns and crisp colonial architecture. I sat nervously in the corridor, waiting to be called in for my interview. I felt stiff in the pantsuit and clung awkwardly to Robin's handbag. But in the end, Professor Steinberg had written such a powerful letter of recommendation that there was little left for me to do. I received confirmation the next day. I'd won the scholarship. The phone calls began, from BYU's student paper and the local news. I did half a dozen interviews. I was on TV. I awoke one morning to find my picture plastered on BYU's homepage. I was the third BYU student ever to win a Gates Scholarship, and the university was taking full advantage of the press. I was asked about my high school experience, and which of my grade school teachers had prepared me for my success. I dodged, I parried, I lied when I had to. I didn't tell a single reporter that I'd never gone to school. I didn't know why I couldn't tell them. I just couldn't stand the thought of people patting me on the back, telling me how impressive I was. I didn't want to be Horatio Alger in someone's tear-filled homage to the American dream. I wanted my life to make sense, and nothing in that narrative made sense to me. A month before my graduation, I visited Buck's Peak. Dad had read the articles about my scholarship, and what he said was,
"You didn't mention homeschool. I'd think you'd be more grateful that your mother and I took you out of them schools, seeing how it's worked out. You should be telling people that's what done it. Homeschool."
I said nothing. Dad took it as an apology. He disapproved of my going to Cambridge.
"Our ancestors risked their lives to cross the ocean to escape those socialist countries. And what do? You turn around and go back?"
Again, I said nothing.
"I'm looking forward to your graduation," he said. "The Lord has a few choice rebukes for me to give them professors."
"You will not," I said quietly.
"If the Lord moves me, I will stand and speak."
"You will not," I repeated.
"I won't go anywhere that the Lord's Spirit isn't welcome."
That was the conversation. I hoped it would blow over, but Dad was so hurt that I hadn't mentioned homeschooling in my interviews that this new wound festered. There was a dinner the night before my graduation where I was to receive the Most Outstanding Undergraduate Award from the History Department. I waited for my parents at the entrance, but they never appeared. I called Mother, thinking they were running late. She said they weren't coming. I went to the dinner and was presented with a plaque. My table had the only empty seats in the hall. The next day, there was a luncheon for honors graduates, and I was seated with the college dean and the director of the honors program. Again, there were two empty seats. I said my parents had had car trouble. I phoned my mother after the luncheon.
"Your father won't come unless you apologize," she said. "And I won't either."
I apologized. "He can say whatever he wants, but please come." They missed most of the ceremony. I don't know if they saw me accept my diploma. What I remember is waiting with my friends before the music began, watching their fathers snap pictures and their mothers fix their hair. I remember that my friends were wearing colorful leis and recently gifted jewelry. After the ceremony, I stood alone on the lawn, watching the other students with their families. Eventually, I saw my parents. Mother hugged me. My friend Laura snapped two photos. One is of me and Mother, smiling our forced smiles. The other is of me wedged between my parents, looking squeezed, under pressure. I was leaving the Mountain West that night. I had packed before graduation. My apartment was empty, my bags by the door. Laura had volunteered to drive me to the airport, but my parents asked if they could take me. I expected them to drop me at the curb, but Dad insisted that they walk with me through the airport. They waited while I checked my bags, then followed me to the security gate. It was as if Dad wanted to give me until the last second to change my mind. We walked in silence. When we arrived at security, I hugged them both and said goodbye. I removed my shoes, laptop, camera, then I passed through the checkpoint, reassembled my pack, and headed for the terminal. It was only then that I glanced back and saw Dad, still standing at the checkpoint, watching me walk away, his hands in his pockets, his shoulders slumping, his mouth slackened. I waved, and he stepped forward as if to follow, and I was reminded of the moment years before when power lines had covered the station wagon with Mother inside it and Dad had stood next to her, exposed. He was still holding that posture when I turned the corner. That image of my father will always stay with me, that look on his face of love and fear and loss. I knew why he was afraid. He'd let it slip my last night on Buck's Peak, the same night he'd said he wouldn't come to see me graduate.
"If you're in America," he'd whispered, "we can come for you, wherever you are. I've got 1,000 gallons of fuel buried in the field. I can fetch you when the end comes, bring you home, make you safe. But if you cross the ocean..."
Part 3. Chapter 30 Hand of the Almighty. A stone gate barred the entrance to Trinity College. Cut into the gate was a small wooden door. I stepped through it. A porter in a black overcoat and bowler hat showed me around the college, leading me through Great Court, the largest of the courtyards. We walked through a stone passageway and into a covered corridor whose stone was the color of ripe wheat.
"This is the North Cloister," the porter said. "It is here that Newton stomped his foot to measure the echo, calculating the speed of sound for the first time."
We returned to the Great Gate. My room was directly opposite it, up three flights of stairs. After the porter left, I stood, bookended by my suitcases, and stared out my little window at the mythic stone gate and its otherworldly battlements. Cambridge was just as I remembered, ancient, beautiful. I was different. I was not a visitor, not a guest. I was a member of the university. My name was painted on the door. According to the paperwork, I belonged here. I dressed in dark colors for my first lecture, hoping I wouldn't stand out, but even so, I didn't think I looked like the other students. I certainly didn't sound like them, and not just because they were British. Their speech had a lilting cadence that made me think of singing more than speaking. To my ears, they sounded refined, educated. I had a tendency to mumble, and when nervous, to stutter. I chose a seat around the large square table and listened as the two students nearest me discussed the lecture topic, which was Isaiah Berlin's Two Concepts of Liberty. The student next to me said he'd studied Isaiah Berlin at Oxford. The other said he'd already heard this lecturer's remarks on Berlin when he was an undergraduate at Cambridge. I had never heard of Isaiah Berlin. The lecturer began his presentation. He spoke calmly, but moved through the material quickly, as if he assumed we were already familiar with it. This was confirmed by the other students, most of whom were not taking notes. I scribbled down every word.
"So, what are Isaiah Berlin's two concepts?" the lecturer asked.
Nearly everyone raised a hand. The lecturer called on the student who had studied at Oxford.
"Negative liberty," he said, "is the freedom from external obstacles or constraints. An individual is free in this sense if they are not physically prevented from taking action."
I was reminded for a moment of Richard, who had always seemed able to recite with exactness anything he'd ever read.
"Very good," the lecturer said. "And the second?"
"Positive liberty," another student said, "is freedom from internal constraints."
I wrote this definition in my notes, but I didn't understand it. The lecturer tried to clarify. He said, "Positive liberty is self-mastery, the rule of the self by the self." To have positive liberty, he explained, is to take control of one's own mind, to be liberated from irrational fears and beliefs, from addictions, superstitions, and all other forms of self-coercion. I had no idea what it meant to self-coerce. I looked around the room. No one else seemed confused. I was one of the few students taking notes. I wanted to ask for further explanation, but something stopped me. The certainty that to do so would be to shout to the room that I didn't belong there. After the lecture, I returned to my room, where I stared out my window at the stone gate with its medieval battlements. I thought of positive liberty and of what it might mean to self-coerce until my head thrummed with a dull ache. I called home. Mother answered. Her voice rose with excitement when she recognized my weepy, "Hello, Mom." I told her I shouldn't have come to Cambridge, that I didn't understand anything. She said she'd been muscle testing and had discovered that one of my chakras was out of balance. She could adjust it, she said. I reminded her that I was 5,000 miles away.
"That doesn't matter," she said. "I'll adjust the chakra on Audrey and wing it to you."
"You'll what it to me?"
"Wing it," she said. "Distance is nothing to living energy. I can send the corrected energy to you from here."
"How fast does energy travel?" I asked. "At the speed of sound, or is it more like a jetliner? Does it fly direct, or will it have to lay over in Minneapolis?"
Mother laughed and hung up. I studied most mornings in the college library, near a small window. I was there on a particular morning when Drew, a friend from BYU, sent me a song via email. He said it was a classic, but I had never heard of it, nor the singer. I played the song through my headphones. It gripped me immediately. I listened to it over and over while staring out at the North Cloister. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. I scratched those lines into notebooks, into the margins of the essays I was writing. I wondered about them when I should have been reading. From the internet, I learned about the cancer that had been discovered on Bob Marley's foot. I also learned that Marley had been a Rastafarian, and that Rastafari believe in a whole body, which is why he had refused surgery to amputate the toe. 4 years later, at age 36, he died. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. Marley had written that line a year before his death, while an operable melanoma was, at that moment, metastasizing to his lungs, liver, stomach, and brain. I imagined a greedy surgeon with sharp teeth and long skeletal fingers urging Marley to have the amputation. I shrank from this frightening image of the doctor and his corrupt medicine, and only then did I understand, as I had not before, that although I had renounced my father's world, I had never quite found the courage to live in this one. I flipped through my notebook to the lecture on negative and positive liberty. In a blank corner, I scratched the line, "None but ourselves can free our minds." Then I picked up my phone and dialed. "I need to get my vaccinations," I told the nurse. I attended a seminar on Wednesday afternoons where I noticed two women, Katrina and Sophie, who nearly always sat together. I never spoke to them until one afternoon a few weeks before Christmas, when they asked if I'd like to get a coffee. I'd never gotten a coffee before. I'd never even tasted coffee, because it is forbidden by the church, but I followed them across the street and into a cafe. The cashier was impatient, so I chose at random. She passed me a doll-sized cup with a tablespoon of mud-colored liquid in it, and I looked longingly at the foamy mugs Katrina and Sophie carried to our table. They debated concepts from the lecture. I debated whether to drink my coffee. They used complex phrases with ease. Some of them, like the second wave, I'd heard before, even if I didn't know what they meant. Others, like the hegemonic masculinity, I couldn't get my tongue around, let alone my mind. I'd taken several sips of the grainy, acrid fluid before I understood that they were talking about feminism. I stared at them as if they were behind glass. I'd never heard anyone use the word feminism as anything but a reprimand. At BYU, "you sound like a feminist" signaled the end of the argument. It also signaled that I had lost. I left the cafe and went to the library. After 5 minutes online and a few trips to the stacks, I was sitting in my usual place with a large pile of books written by what I now understood to be second-wave writers: Betty Friedan, Germaine Greer, Simone de Beauvoir. I read only a few pages of each book before slamming it shut. I'd never seen the word vagina printed out, never said it aloud. I returned to the internet and then to the shelves, where I exchanged the books of the second wave for those that preceded the first, Mary Wollstonecraft and John Stuart Mill. I read through the afternoon and into the evening, developing for the first time a vocabulary for the uneasiness I'd felt since childhood. From the moment I had first understood that my brother Richard was a boy and I was a girl, I had wanted to exchange his future for mine. My future was motherhood, his fatherhood. They sounded similar, but they were not. To be one was to be a decider, to preside, to call the family to order. To be the other was to be among those called. I knew my yearning was unnatural. This knowledge, like so much of my self-knowledge, had come to me in the voice of people I knew, people I loved. All through the years, that voice had been with me, whispering, wondering, worrying,
that I was not right, that my dreams were perversions. That voice had many timbres, many tones. Sometimes it was my father's voice. More often, it was my own. I carried the books to my room and read through the night. I loved the fiery pages of Mary Wollstonecraft, but there was a single line written by John Stuart Mill that, when I read it, moved the world. It is a subject on which nothing final can be known. The subject Mill had in mind was the nature of women. Mill claimed that women have been coaxed, cajoled, shoved and squashed into a series of feminine contortions for so many centuries that it is now quite impossible to define their natural abilities or aspirations. Blood rushed to my brain. I felt an animating surge of adrenaline, of possibility, of a frontier being pushed outward. Of the nature of women, nothing final can be known. Never had I found such comfort in a void, in the black absence of knowledge. It seemed to say, whatever you are woman. In December, after I had submitted my last essay, I took a train to London and boarded a plane. Mother, Audrey, and Emily picked me up at the airport in Salt Lake City, and together we skidded onto the interstate. It was nearly midnight when the mountain came into view. I could only just make out her grand form against the inky sky. When I entered the kitchen, I noticed a gaping hole in the wall, which led to a new extension Dad was building. Mother walked with me through the hole and switched on the light.
"Amazing, isn't it?" she said.
Amazing was the word. It was a single, massive room the size of the chapel at church, with a vaulted ceiling that rose some 16 feet into the air. The size of the room was so ridiculous it took me a moment to notice the decor. The walls were exposed sheetrock, which contrasted spectacularly with the wood paneling on the vaulted ceiling. Crimson suede sofas sat cordially next to the stained upholstery love seat my father had dragged in from the dump many years before. Thick rugs with intricate patterns covered half the floor, while the other half was raw cement. There were several pianos, only one of which looked playable, and a television the size of a dining table. The room suited my father perfectly. It was larger than life and wonderfully incongruous. Dad had always said he wanted to build a room the size of a cruise ship, but I'd never thought he'd have the money. I looked to Mother for an explanation, but it was Dad who answered. The business was a roaring success, he explained. Essential oils were popular, and Mother had the best on the market.
"Our oils are so good," he said. "We started eating into the profits of the large corporate producers. They know all about them Westovers in Idaho."
Dad told me that one company had been so alarmed by the success of Mother's oils, they had offered to buy her out for an astonishing $3 million. My parents hadn't even considered it. Healing was their calling. No amount of money could tempt them. Dad explained that they were taking the bulk of their profits and reconsecrating them to God in the form of supplies, fuel, maybe even a real bomb shelter. I suppressed a grin. From what I could tell, Dad was on track to become the best-funded lunatic in the Mountain West. Richard appeared on the stairwell. He was finishing his undergraduate degree in chemistry at Idaho State. He'd come home for Christmas, and he'd brought his wife, Cammy, and their one-month-old son, Donovan. When I'd met Cammy a year before, just before the wedding, I'd been struck by how normal she was. Like Tyler's wife, Stephanie, Cammy was an outsider. She was a Mormon, but she was what Dad would have called mainstream. She thanked Mother for her herbal advice, but seemed oblivious to the expectation that she renounce doctors. Donovan had been born in a hospital. I wondered how Richard was navigating the turbulent waters between his normal wife and his abnormal parents. I watched him closely that night, and to me it seemed he was trying to live in both worlds, to be a loyal adherent to all creeds. When my father condemned doctors as minions of Satan, Richard turned to Cammy and gave a small laugh, as if Dad were joking.
But when my father's eyebrows rose, Richard's expression changed to one of serious contemplation and accord. He seemed in a state of constant transition, phasing in and out of dimensions, unsure whether to be my father's son or his wife's husband. Mother was overwhelmed with holiday orders, so I passed my days on Buck's Peak just as I had as a child, in the kitchen, making homeopathics. I poured the distilled water and added the drops from the base formula, then passed the tiny glass bottle through the ring made by my thumb and index finger, counting to 50 or 100, then moving on to the next. Dad came in for a drink of water. He smiled when he saw me.
"Who knew we'd have to send you to Cambridge to get you in the kitchen where you belong?" he said.
In the afternoons, Sean and I saddled the horses and fought our way up the mountain, the horses half-jumping to clamber through snowdrifts that reached their bellies. The mountain was beautiful and crisp, the air smelled of leather and pine. Sean talked about the horses, about their training, and about the colts he expected in the spring, and I remembered that he was always at his best when he was with his horses. I had been home about a week when the mountain was gripped by an intense cold spell. The temperature plunged, dropping to zero, then dropping further still. We put the horses away, knowing that if they worked up a sweat, it would turn to ice on their backs. The trough froze solid. We broke the ice, but it refroze quickly, so we carried buckets of water to each horse. That night, everyone stayed indoors. Mother was blending oils in the kitchen. Dad was in the extension, which I had begun to jokingly call the chapel. He was lying on the crimson sofa, a Bible resting on his stomach, while Cammy and Richard played hymns on the piano. I sat with my laptop on the love seat, near Dad, and listened to the music. I had just begun a message to Drew when something struck the back door. The door burst open, and Emily flew into the room. Her thin arms were wrapped around her body, and she was shaking, gasping for breath. She wore no coat, no shoes, nothing but jeans, an old pair I'd left behind, and one of my worn t-shirts. Mother helped her to the sofa, wrapping her in the nearest blanket. Emily bawled, and for several minutes not even Mother could get her to say what had happened. Was everyone all right? Where was Peter? He was fragile, half the size he should have been, and he wore oxygen tubes because his lungs had never fully developed. Had his tiny lungs collapsed? His breathing stopped? The story came out haltingly, between erratic sobs and the clattering of teeth. From what I could tell, when Emily had gone to Stokes that afternoon to buy groceries, she had returned home with the wrong crackers for Peter. Sean had exploded. "How can he grow if you can't buy the right food?" he had screamed. Then he'd gathered her up and flung her from their trailer into a snowbank. She'd pounded on the door, begging to be let in. Then she'd run up the hillside to the house. I stared at her bare feet as she said this. They were so red they looked as if they'd been burned. My parents sat with Emily on the sofa, one on each side of her, patting her shoulders and squeezing her hands. Richard paced a few feet behind them. He seemed frustrated, anxious, as if he wanted to explode into action and was only just being held in check. Cammy was still seated at the piano. She was staring at the group huddled on the couch, confused. She had not understood Emily. She did not understand why Richard was pacing, or why he paused every few seconds to glance at Dad, waiting for a word or gesture, any signal of what should be done. I looked at Cammy and felt a tightening in my chest. I resented her for witnessing this. I imagined myself in Emily's place, which was easy to do. I couldn't stop myself from doing it. And in a moment, I was in a parking lot, laughing my high-pitched cackle, trying to convince the world that my wrist wasn't breaking. Before I knew what I was doing, I had crossed the room. I grasped my brother's arm and pulled him with me to the piano. Emily was still sobbing, and I used her sobs to muffle my whispers. I told Cammy that what we were witnessing was private, and that Emily would be embarrassed by it tomorrow. For Emily's sake, I said, we should all go to our rooms and leave it in Dad's hands. Cammy stood. She had decided to trust me. Richard hesitated, giving Dad a long look, Then he followed her from the room. I walked with them down the hallway, then I doubled back. I sat at the kitchen table and watched the clock. 5 minutes passed, then 10. Come on, Sean, I chanted under my breath. Come now. I'd convinced myself that if Sean appeared in the next few minutes, it would be to make sure Emily had made it to the house, that she hadn't slipped on the ice and broken a leg, wasn't freezing to death in a field. But he didn't come. 20 minutes later, when Emily finally stopped shaking, Dad picked up the phone.
Come get your wife, he shouted into it.
Mother was cradling Emily's head against her shoulder. Dad returned to the sofa and patted Emily's arm. As I stared at the three of them huddling together, I had the impression that all of this had happened before, and that everyone's part was well rehearsed, even mine. It would be many years before I would understand what had happened that night and what my role in it had been, how I had opened my mouth when I should have stayed silent and shut it when I should have spoken out. What was needed was a revolution, a reversal of the ancient, brittle roles we'd been playing out since my childhood. What was needed, what Emily needed, was a woman emancipated from pretense, a woman who could show herself to be a man. Voice an opinion, take action in scorn of deference. A father. The French doors my father had installed squawked as they opened. Sean shuffled in wearing heavy boots and a thick winter coat. Peter emerged from the folds of thick wool, where Sean had been shielding him from the cold, and reached out for Emily. She clung to him. Dad stood. He motioned for Sean to take the seat next to Emily. I stood and went to my room, pausing to take a last look at my father, who was inhaling deeply, readying himself to deliver a lengthy lecture. It was very stern, Mother assured me 20 minutes later, when she appeared at my door asking if I could lend Emily a pair of shoes and a coat. I fetched them and watched from the kitchen as she disappeared, tucked under my brother's arm. Chapter 31. Tragedy, then farce. The day before I returned to England, I drove 7 miles along the mountain range, then turned onto a narrow dirt road and stopped in front of a powder blue house. I parked behind an RV that was nearly as large as the house itself. I knocked. My sister answered. She stood in the doorway in flannel pajamas, a toddler on her hip, and 2 small girls clinging to her leg. Her son, about 6, stood behind her. Audrey stepped aside to let me pass, but her movements were stiff, and she avoided looking directly at me. We'd spent little time together since she'd married. I moved into the house, stopping abruptly in the entryway when I saw a 3-foot hole in the linoleum that plunged to the basement. I walked past the hole and into the kitchen, which was filled with the scent of our mother's oils, birch, eucalyptus, raven sarah. The conversation was slow, halting. Audrey asked me no questions about England or Cambridge. She had no frame of reference for my life, so we talked about hers, how the public school system was corrupt, so she was teaching her children herself at home. Like me, Audrey had never attended a public school. When she was 17, she had made a fleeting effort to get her GED. She had even enlisted the help of our cousin Missy, who had come up from Salt Lake City to tutor her. Missy had worked with Audrey for an entire summer, at the end of which she'd declared that Audrey's education hovered somewhere between the 4th and 5th grade levels, and that a GED was out of the question. I chewed my lip and stared at her daughter, who had brought me a drawing, wondering what education she could hope to receive from a mother who had none herself. We made breakfast for the children, then played with them in the snow. We baked, we watched crime dramas, and designed beaded bracelets. It was as if I had stepped through a mirror and was living a day in the life I might have had if I'd stayed on the mountain. But I hadn't stayed. My life had diverged from my sister's, and it felt as though there was no common ground between us. The hours passed. It was late afternoon. and still she felt distant from me. Still she refused to meet my gaze. I had brought a small porcelain tea set for her children, and when they began to quarrel over the teapot, I gathered up the pieces. The oldest girl reminded me that she was 5 now, which she said was too old to have a toy taken away. "If you act like a child," I said, "I'll treat you like one." I don't know why I said it. I suppose Sean was on my mind. I regretted the words even as they left my lips, hated myself for saying them. I turned to pass the tea set to my sister so she could administer justice however she saw fit, but when I saw her expression, I nearly dropped it. Her mouth hung open in a perfect circle. "Sean used to say that," she said, fixing her eyes on mine. That moment would stay with me. I would remember it the next day when I boarded a plane in Salt Lake City, and it would still be on my mind when I landed in London. It was the shock of it that I couldn't shake. Somehow, it had never occurred to me that my sister might have lived my life before I did. That term, I presented myself to the university like resin to a sculptor. I believed I could be remade, my mind recast. I forced myself to befriend other students, clumsily introducing myself again and again until I had a small circle of friends. Then I set out to obliterate the barriers that separated me from them. I tasted red wine for the first time, and my new friends laughed at my pinched face. I discarded my high-necked blouses and began to wear more fashionable cuts, fitted, often sleeveless, with less restrictive necklines. In photos from this period, I'm struck by the symmetry. I look like everyone else. In April, I began to do well. I wrote an essay on John Stuart Mill's concept of self-sovereignty, and my supervisor, Dr. David Runciman, said that if my dissertation was of the same quality, I might be accepted to Cambridge for a PhD. I was stunned. I, who had sneaked into this grand place as an imposter, might now enter through the front door. I set to work on my dissertation, again choosing Mill as the topic. One afternoon, near the end of term, when I was eating lunch in the library cafeteria, I recognized a group of students from my program. They were seated together at a small table. I asked if I could join them, and a tall Italian named Nick nodded. From the conversation, I gathered that Nick had invited the others to visit him in Rome during the spring holiday. "You can come too," he said. We handed in our final essays for the term, then boarded a plane. On our first evening in Rome, we climbed one of the 7 hills and looked out over the metropolis. Byzantine domes hovered over the city like rising balloons. It was nearly dusk. The streets were bathed in amber. It wasn't the color of a modern city, of steel, glass, and concrete. It was the color of sunset. It didn't look real. Nick asked me what I thought of his home, and that was all I could say. It didn't look real. At breakfast the next morning, the others talked about their families. Someone's father was a diplomat, another's was an Oxford don. I was asked about my parents. I said my father owned a junkyard. Nick took us to the conservatory where he'd studied violin. It was in the heart of Rome and was richly furnished, with a grand staircase and resonant halls. I tried to imagine what it would have been like to study in such a place, to walk across marble floors each morning and, day after day, come to associate learning with beauty. But my imagination failed me. I could only imagine the school as I was experiencing it now, as a kind of museum, a relic from someone else's life. For 2 days we explored Rome, a city that is both a living organism and a fossil. Bleached structures from antiquity lay like dried bones, embedded in pulsating cables and thrumming traffic, the arteries of modern life. We visited the Pantheon, the Roman Forum, the Sistine Chapel. My instinct was to worship, to venerate. That was how I felt toward the whole city, that it should be behind glass, adored from a distance, never touched, never altered. My companions moved through the city differently, aware of its significance, but not subdued by it. They were not hushed by the Trevi Fountain. They were not silenced by the Colosseum. Instead, as we moved from one relic to the next, they debated philosophy. Hobbes and Descartes, Aquinas and Machiavelli. There was a kind of symbiosis in their relationship to these grand places. They gave life to the ancient architecture by making it the backdrop of their discourse, by refusing to worship at its altar as if it were a dead thing. On the third night, there was a rainstorm. I stood on Nick's balcony and watched streaks of lightning race across the sky, claps of thunder chasing them. It was like being on Buck's Peak to feel such power in the earth and sky. The next morning was cloudless. We took a picnic of wine and pastries to the grounds of the Villa Borghese. The sun was hot, the pastries ambrosial. I could not remember ever feeling more present. Someone said something about Hobbes, and without thinking, I recited a line from Mill. It seemed the natural thing, to bring this voice from the past into a moment so saturated with the past already, even if the voice was mixed with my own. There was a pause while everyone checked to see who had spoken. Then someone asked which text the line was from, and the conversation moved forward. For the rest of the week, I experienced Rome as they did, as a place of history, but also as a place of life, of food and traffic and conflict and thunder. The city was no longer a museum. It was as vivid to me as Buck's Peak, the Piazza del Popolo, the baths of Caracalla, Castel Sant'Angelo. These became as real to my mind as the princess, the red railway car, the sheer. The world they represented, of philosophy, science, literature, an entire civilization, took on a life that was distinct from the life I had known. At the Galleria Nazionale d'Arte Antica, I stood before Caravaggio's Judith beheading Holofernes and did not once think about chickens. I don't know what caused the transformation, why suddenly I could engage with the great thinkers of the past rather than revere them to the point of muteness, but there was something about that city, with its white marble and black asphalt, crusted with history, ablaze in traffic lights, that showed me I could admire the past without being silenced by it. I was still breathing in the fustiness of ancient stone when I arrived in Cambridge. I rushed up the staircase, anxious to check my email, knowing there would be a message from Drew. When I opened my laptop, I saw that Drew had written, but so had someone else, my sister. I opened Audrey's message. It was written in one long paragraph, with little punctuation and many spelling errors, and at first I fixated on these grammatical irregularities as a way to mute the text. But the words would not be hushed. They shouted at me from the screen. The language from the referenced email is paraphrased, not directly quoted. The meaning has been preserved. Audrey said she should have stopped Sean many years ago, before he could do to me what he'd done to her. She said that when she was young, she'd wanted to tell Mother, to ask for help, but she'd thought Mother wouldn't believe her. She'd been right. Before her wedding, she'd experienced nightmares and flashbacks, and she'd told Mother about them. Mother had said the memories were false, impossible. "I should have helped you," Audrey wrote, "but when my own mother didn't believe me, I stopped believing myself." It was a mistake she was going to correct. "I believe God will hold me accountable if I don't stop Sean from hurting anyone else," she wrote. She was going to confront him and our parents, and she was asking me to stand with her. "I am doing this with or without you, but without you, I will probably lose." I sat in the dark for a long time. I resented her for writing me. I felt she had torn me from one world, one life, where I was happy, and dragged me back into another. I typed a response. I told her she was right, that of course we should stop Sean, but I asked her to do nothing until I could return to Idaho. I don't know why I asked her to wait, what benefit I thought time would yield. I don't know what I thought would happen when we talked to our parents, but I understood instinctively what was at stake. As long as we had never asked, it was possible to believe that they would help. To tell them was to risk the